This is Starters for the Rest of Us, episode 98. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
And I'm Rob.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. How are you doing this week, Rob?
I'm doing pretty well. I'm back off of about 48 hours of being completely offline. We went to the central coast of California around Big Sur area and went camping with car camping with my two kids and then my brother and his five kids, brother and his wife.
What is car camping?
You go to a campsite and you pull your car in and then you park within a walk of that. Like there's typically a picnic table, fire pit set up, and you set up a tent. And you just have kind of this little camp spot there. And it's, frankly, before we had kids, we always backpacked, right? And you do a 4-mile hike up a hill, 7-mile hike up some hill to a lake. But when you have a 2- and a 6-year-old, that's just not as conducive.
I see. Yeah, I'm outdoorsy in that I like drinking on patios.
Yeah, I know. No, totally. It's good to get out in nature and all that, but it's tough, man. It's tough with kids and trying to get all the, it was 40-something degrees at night, so I kept worrying that the kids were going to be too cold and had to lug air mattresses. Normally, again, I would sleep on, a little mat. It was fun, made s'mores, did some hiking, saw some waterfalls.
Cool.
But I was totally gone with no, it was weird. I've gone places with just my phone for several days at a time, and you can just check email and make sure no emergencies came through. But man, I was off the grid for a couple of days, and from Sunday until Tuesday, and frankly, it was pretty refreshing.
Really? I find it disconcerting when my cell phone just doesn't work at all.
Well, here's the thing. It was disconcerting for about the first day because it's like, well, I need to check, where we are. Where's the map? You can't map. And then there'd be someone mentioned something. Oh, yeah, that one movie. I want to find out who it is. And I go to look it up in Google and it's like, you can't do that. But then I felt like I slowly started to adjust, like I adjust out of that. Actually the fast pace of life kind of goes away. And I started feeling like just more calm. In that sense, I would rather be away for a longer period because I think if I had hung out for maybe a week offline, I'd have gotten more used to it. But it's hard for me to get back into work when I come back. Essentially I had 5 days off, right? Fine, you have that issue when you come back?
Yeah, to some extent. I mean, if I'm just completely disconnected for whatever reason, it seems like it takes a couple of days to kind of work my way back into, I'll say, a mental state where I'm going to be actually productive. I think a lot of it has to do with just trying to figure out, okay, well, now I'm back to work. What should I do? What should I do first? Because there's a billion things to do. And it's just because there's so much to do, you're just not really sure where to start sometimes.
Yeah, I almost feel like it's a learned skill. The more I go away on these short trips, these 1- and 2-day trips in addition to the weekend, I'm starting to do it once a month, twice a month, just, go to the coast or whatever. Yeah, I'm becoming better at being productive once I get back. And I feel like certain people, and I'm one of them, has a real hard time getting back. And other people come back refreshed, right? You take 4 days off and you come back and they're just like chomping at the bit and getting all types of stuff done. But I'm not there yet.
Got it.
What's going on?
I've just been, reworking some of the back-end database in AuditShark to support some fun stuff called bidirectional database synchronization.
Oh, what are you doing that for?
The short answer, there's a component in AuditShark that people will install locally, and it needs to synchronize with the cloud database.
The component has a database built into it?
Yes.
Okay.
It's basically about making database calls back to my database and be able to store that information. That's really what it is.
And are there any, you're working in .NET, right?
Mm-hmm.
Are there any libraries that help with that kind of stuff, or you have to write it from scratch?
There is a synchronization library that Microsoft publishes, but you have to have certain database columns in place in your database. And what I've done is I've basically shoehorned these new columns into the database. There's like 11 different database tables that I need them in. And essentially what you do is you have to put 4 columns in each of the tables. And then you also have to create like a tombstone table for each of those tables. So I had to add 11 tables and then put 2 new fields in each of these new tables. And then in addition to that change, I had to add 4 more columns to every one of the existing 11 tables.
I love that phrase, tombstone tables.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's because if you delete something and you're trying to synchronize between two tables, how do you know where it was deleted?
Right, right.
Or where it was added, because it could be in either one. It could be deleted from one table or added to another. And depending on which way you do the synchronization first, you might be adding it or you might be deleting it. You have to keep track of that stuff, which kind of sucks. But it's getting close to being done. So once I get that done, then I can move on to other things. And I'm working with some people from Microsoft on helping get some of the other stuff in Audit Shark set up for automated and testing and deployment. Because right now, I'm not doing a heck of a lot of changes that I think need to be tested extremely strenuously, but I can see it down the future. And I'm trying to get into a position where down the road, I'm not going to have to worry about that as much, because I'm going to have like a full-blown staging environment that's going to be mostly a copy of production and like a true staging environment, which Azure doesn't really offer you that.
You said you're working with folks from Microsoft, like their support or their technical help?
They are BizSpark developers.
Developer liaisons or something?
Kind of, yeah. And like, you know, they reach out to you and say, hey, do you have any questions or problems or anything we can help you with? And then, you know, I have this problem. So I've gone back and forth with them a couple of times. And right now, at first, I was just working with one person. He handed it off because he wasn't technical enough. That person basically involved somebody else. And now I'm involved with like three different people kind of talking about it because it's just such a giant issue.
Got it. Did you tell them about your tombstone tables?
No, I did not.
Okay. I wanted to talk about a new iTunes review, and it's from RC in New York City. He says, great podcast, like the title says, for the rest of us. I discovered this podcast on Stitcher when I ran out of tech entrepreneurial stuff to listen to, and boy, was I pleasantly surprised. I was used to the tech. I like this next phrase. Very good turn of phrase. I was used to the tech luminary type podcasts where people bask in the glory of their own light and speak in obtuse generalities. Sir, you have quite a vocabulary. Being a non-tech wannapreneur, it was refreshing and informative to hear the tough examples, experiences, and tips and tricks of Rob and Mike as they slog week to week to make their projects slash businesses a success. So thanks for that review, RC and NYC. We're up over 200 ratings now. Really appreciate a rating and or a review in iTunes if you get the chance.
You know, I got an email from a listener who had also sent me, he'd heard that I was talking about putting together documentation for Audit Shark. And although I've hired somebody to do it who has a background in writing documentation for compliance and security products, so I don't really need this, but the product he pointed me to was it was something called Screen Steps Live from Blue Mango Learning. And it looks like it's a SaaS application where essentially you sign up for a subscription and they'll essentially host your videos and kind of streamline the process for building FAQs and tutorials and things like that for your product. So if you don't have access to developers, it's a great tool to leverage that. But they do aim it specifically at non-developers. And I know that we do have a number of non-developers who listen to the podcast. So I thought I'd share that little tidbit that he sent over to me.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Man, they need to get a better domain name. They're at bluemangolearning.com/screensteps live.
Mm-hmm.
Probably not ideal. I search for their product name, especially expecting it to be .com or something. So product sure looks interesting for that niche.
Mm-hmm.
So I am working on basically a bit of procrastination because I don't actually want to do real work. And every month about this time, I'm looking at my Hittail dashboard and I'm trying to figure out where am I going to be at the end of the month. You know, there's revenue sources coming from a few different things. I have old billing, I have new billing, I have article billing, I have just a lot of stuff to add up and prorate for the rest of the month. And I found that, you know, there are so many ups and downs during the month. There are just certain days where a lot of people signed up one month. And so doing a simple prorating of, hey, we're X days into the month, multiply that by out to 30 or 31 days is just not accurate. So I'm working on a more intelligent prediction query for Hittail, but it's surprisingly challenging. You know, I know the conversion rate of how many people go from trial to paid during a particular 30-day period, but if I'm halfway through that period for them and they're still there, then they have a higher chance of sticking around. So I can't just use this blanket percentage across everyone. I actually have to prorate the conversion percentage across people who are still there. So I've only spent about 15, 20 minutes on it yet. But like I said, it's not super productive per se, but I do feel like it's going to give me some better insight into where I'm going to stand at the end of each month. And I'm still trying to sort out if knowing that information is actually helpful or if it's just mentally helpful for me.
Well, I think it might help prevent you from becoming distracted and thinking about it more often, because if you have a dashboard that's accurate and shows you that information and you've already done the code behind it to know that it's pretty close to being accurate, then you won't think about it as much to try and figure out all the different scenarios for, oh, well, my conversion rate last month was this and the month before that it was this. And you're trying to figure out and do some mental interpolation between those and figure out what your conversion rate is going to end up bringing in for revenue this month. So if you're not thinking about all those different things, kind of frees up your brain to think about other stuff.
Yeah, that's a good point. And that's actually the way I look at it. Because every time I look at this dashboard, I know that 90% of the numbers, I'm like, yep, those are on. But this one, I'm just like, because I have just a simple flat prorated prediction now. And every time I look at it, I'm like, I know that doesn't include this. I know it doesn't include people who are currently in the trial funnel. I mean, it's such a weak estimate that I'm not taking it seriously. And every week, probably, I do want to have an idea of where I stand this month and where I look to be by the end of the month. And so I download an Excel file from PayPal and I go through some manual work, and add it all up by hand just to see where it is. And it'd be so much better to have that for real.
Well, I have a question for you. I mean, you obviously have all this historical data, right?
I do.
Why don't you go back to the historical data that you have and try and figure out, develop an algorithm that will guess at what it should be at the end of each month, and then take a look at those and see how close it is to being accurate, as opposed to trying to kind of guess, because that's basically what you're doing right now is you're guessing, and then you're going to have to wait a couple of weeks to try and figure out whether that's accurate or not, as opposed to going back and looking at all the historical data. And you already have that stuff, so you can essentially run through the algorithm, see if it's right at different points along the month, see how close it is, and just kind of do a percent gap and say, oh, it's within 5% or 10% tolerance of this number, and that's good enough as long as it's that close.
Right. No, that would be good to do, except for the historical data I have. These are live customer records. And so the data is actually not in the form it was when I was in, say, the middle of May. So in the middle of May, I had X number of trials, certain number of people had canceled by that point. But over the next 15 days in May, as more people canceled, then they get set to inactive. So their records are actually different now. So I don't actually have a snapshot of the database on that day. That makes sense. So I can't go back and rerun the algorithm based on what it looked like at that point.
Oh,
but
I see.
You know what I'm saying? Like, because it's not like I have some huge data mining thing that took a snapshot of it every day and I could run it. It's live data that has changed since then.
I see. You're not tracking historical events so much as you are changing the records of the individuals that are in the system.
That's right. And if I were a couple things. One, if I was architecting the system, I would, of course, have a cancellation date instead of an active bit, because then you have actual information, right? Then I could go back and do exactly what you're saying. But I didn't architect the system, and it's not worth me for this thing. It's not worth me going back in, adding a bunch of code just to get a little better prediction algorithm. I think even given what I have, I could probably spend less than an hour right now and get within, 5 to 10% without changing app code.
I see.
So, yeah. But I like your approach. That's exactly that'd be the ideal approach to it.
Yeah. What I did recently was I had a developer who built the webhooks for Stripe, and so that whenever Stripe does something, it basically sends out information back to this webhook that's on my server and sends it, just information about, hey, this is just what happened, and it sends JSON over, through that request. And I had a developer who built two different things. One was to go into Stripe and pull in pretty much every single webhook that has, been processed over the past 30 days. And then the second one is to actually implement something so that, there is a webhook out there that I can have live, so that whenever Stripe does something, it will kick off, it will send something to that. And all I do is I take the entire JSON query and send it directly into my database, so that if I ever need to do post-processing on it later, I don't have to worry about it, because Stripe only keeps track of the last 30 days of webhooks that they've basically sent out, or the last 30 days of events. So to get around that, I basically just save every single JSON query that they send to my webhook and throw it in a database. And it's not like I really care about the storage space or anything like that. And then if I ever need to run through and do any post-processing on anything all the way back to the beginning of time, I can do it.
How interesting. Yeah, I haven't done any of the webhook stuff. I've looked at it as kind of premature optimization. I didn't even know they only held it for 30 days. What kind of information do they have that you could need? Because I haven't had a need. I've been running on Stripe for about 9 months, and I haven't had a need to go look at that stuff. What kind of information that I don't have right now would you have in your database?
So they have whenever somebody signs up, they have whenever there's a cancellation, they have whenever payment was attempted but failed, whenever payment was succeeded, whenever they send you money. I mean, pretty much any given API call that happens, they keep a record of it.
So you're looking at the logs, right? You're logging events is what you're doing. Because I can get that data, but I only get the data. I can look at the customers and look at the payments and look at the this and that, but I can't look at the event of when that happened.
Right.
And that's what you're getting.
Yes.
Got it.
I mean, I don't have any specific use for it right now, but it was a task that I was able to turn, you know, send out there. And I knew that once that 30-day time period goes by, I'm not going to have that data ever again. So if I ever need it in the future, it would be good to have it. And if I don't ever use it, that's fine. It's not like I actually did the work on it anyway. I just scoped it out and said, here's what I need. And it took me, it was like literally 5 minutes of my time to say, this is what I need.
You realize the phrase, if I ever need it in the future, is the very definition of premature scaling that we talked about in the last episode?
You know, but I think with the premature scaling, you're also talking about something that takes more than 5 minutes of your time.
Right, right. You said something to me shortly before we hit record.
I had just said something like, oh, I hate Java. And you asked me if I was working with Java. And I said, no, I would shoot myself if I had to code in Java.
And why is that? Did you code Java back in the day?
I did for a while. It just irritated me for some reason. I don't know why. Part of it was the IDEs that you had to work with. And don't get me wrong, I haven't worked with Java in probably 9 years. So
you're still going to get hate mail.
Yeah.
And you know what people should send you is, Java's not bad. You work with .NET, you idiot.
I don't care. I just, you know, it rubbed me the wrong way when I was working with it. And it was just seemed like they were always making these weird changes that didn't make a whole heck of a lot of sense. And then they came out with NetBeans and this and that.
It was pretty gnarly. It was complicated. Like,
what is all of this stuff? It just didn't make any sense to me. And so I just kind of got away from it. And
I coded Java for about 18 months. And I found it complex, is my memory of it. I remember there being no good IDEs for it. And I remember it being extremely complicated. I'm a .NET developer. Like, .NET is not simple compared to PHP and Ruby and Python and you know, those types of frameworks. Java really kind of pushed it over the top. And maybe it was the documentation wasn't good, so it just seemed complex. But it was definitely a struggle to build things that are easier to do in a lot of other languages. I was also building web apps, and I just don't think it's the ideal language to build web apps with.
Yeah, I don't either. I would attribute a lot of it to the IDE.
Right.
I think that the reason I think that is because, at least with .NET, if you're typing something, you get this little interface that pops up that you're starting to type a function, and it just, you know, will autocomplete for you, and it will show you all the command line parameters for that. Whereas if you have a bad IDE in, you know, for Java, you're not getting any of that. But with .NET, you're working with Visual Studio, and everything is right there. You don't generally have to worry about it.
Yeah, most languages don't have the IntelliSense that .NET does, and you get so spoiled by it as a developer because it dramatically improves your productivity. But when I step into PHP, I'll just say it takes me a lot longer because I have to sit there and look everything up. It doesn't auto-populate it like it does with .NET.
Yeah, the other issue I think I had with Java was all the debugging.
Oh, I remember spending like 6 hours just getting step through debugging working on a JSP server. So Mike and I are going to be talking about 8 sentiments that do not bode well for your startup. And realistically, these are a bit tongue-in-cheek. But, you know, before the call, Mike and I were talking about how each of us, including us here on the podcast, as well as most people out there and most entrepreneurs that we talk to, make at least one of these mistakes, and typically several of them, during the time of building and launching a product. So the first sentiment is, quote, this product idea is awesome. Now off to the basement to build it. I'll see you in 6 months. How many times have we covered that on this podcast?
At least one.
We've talked about this, certainly with AutoChark. You built it for quite a while before, you know, showing the actual app to customers. I think we see this every day. We get questions from podcast listeners who basically say, glad I found your podcast. I've already built this app and I'm about to launch it, but I have no mailing list. I haven't done any marketing. That might be the most common email I get these days, actually, is I have this product and either I'm just about to launch or I launched a month ago and no one's buying and I don't know what to do now. And typically my first thing is, well, does anyone want this? Like, have you talked to customers? If you didn't do it before you built, then you need to do it now so that you can determine if you should, you know, even continue with this product. There's like, there's no reason to throw good money after bad.
Or good time after bad.
Indeed. So our second sentiment that does not bode well for your startup is, I haven't even finished the features I want to build yet, and potential customers are already asking me to build X.
I love this one because it's the translation to this is basically, I'm sticking to my product idea no matter what my potential customers tell me. I have this vision in my head of stuff that I want to build, but people are asking me to do this other stuff, and I'm not done yet. I'm not done yet. I still want to do this other stuff. And what they're telling you is what they want and what they are willing to pay for, and what you're telling them is, no, I'm going to do this because this is my vision. You're basically saying, my vision is more important than what my customers want.
Yeah, and this is a really hard balance because as soon as you launch an app and as soon as you have people using it, you're going to get feature requests, especially if you launch when you're still a little embarrassed about your product. And I think most V1.0s are, they should be launched when you're still a little embarrassed about it. So you're going to get a slew of feature requests, and it's up to you to figure out, well, which ones of these should I actually implement? Which ones of these maybe line up with my vision? Which ones don't, but are still worth implementing and maybe even have a higher priority than the features I have in mind? Because frankly, your product can go down an entirely different road than you imagined, and it could be more useful to your potential audience if they're using it in a way that you never thought possible.
Yeah, and it's interesting the dynamic here, because I was actually having a conversation last night with a prospective partner of Audit Shark, and he's asking me, he's like, what do you see as the vision for this? You know, what do you envision this turning into down the road? But I basically, you know, put it bluntly, and I'm like, you know, the product direction is going to be driven by what the customers want. And at the end of the day, if I do what the customers want, then I'll make a metric ton of money. It's not going to matter, but it's really about what they want, not necessarily what I want for the product.
Yeah. And again, that is it's a hard thing to do, to actually implement what you've just said, because it's hard to know when you get 20, 30, 40 customers all sending you a request, you can't do everything the customers want. You have to parse it out and figure out which one or which set of features is actually the thing that you can implement that's going to help the most customers and attract the most new customers to the product. So the third sentiment that does not bode well for your startup is, I'm halfway done with this idea, but that shiny new one over there seems so much better.
Aren't we all guilty of this one?
Yeah, absolutely. Every month. Yeah, I'm currently evaluating, let's just say, a couple other potential acquisitions. And I'm in due diligence right now. I've signed an NDA on one. And right away, you know, I told it to one of my mastermind groups. And one of the guys was like, what are you doing? Like, I feel like you're taking your eye off the ball. You know, he didn't say it quite like that, but in so many words.
I'll say it. I feel like you're taking your eye off the ball.
Yeah, no, it's definitely something in the back of my mind. I mean, if you listen back 10 episodes, I've been talking about this, you know, about to shift focus, because there's this thing that I've said over and over. It's that I never work on two products. I never try to grow two products at the same time. Anytime I've tried to do that, I've failed because there's just too much to do. Now, I have a couple tricks up my sleeve that I've never had in the past, but the bottom line is it's a risky game and it's always a gamble if you're going to try to either do two ideas at once or, even worse, just leap from one half completed idea to the next, because that's a good way to kill 3, 4, 5 years of your entrepreneurial career and never actually launch anything. And launching is when you really start learning.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can take a look at the hard drive of just about any developer and just count the number of unfinished products, and that right there will give you a good idea of, you know, how, I guess, pervasive this particular problem is. I mean, there are people who just leap from product to product or, you know, project to project because they never actually finish anything. And after 2, 3, 5, 8 years of working on this stuff, they still have nothing to show for it. And, you know, I think we're all guilty of that at some point. I mean, there's always these projects that we get involved in that you kind of get bogged down, you lose your motivation to work on it, and it's no longer as exciting and sexy to kind of push through to the finish line because you don't have customers yet. There's nobody really relying on it yet. And you're just like, well, you know, that looks really interesting. You know, it's very easy to get distracted and go in a different direction.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong here. I'm not saying don't own multiple products, because obviously that's, you know, really the approach that I've taken on, and I've had success with it. It's not to bounce from idea to idea without completing one and either getting it to a state of automation or of some type of semi-autopiloted state where you're not just having to really focus on it to make it grow all the time. Our fourth sentiment that does not bode well for your startup is, I plan to quit my job 60 days after I launch. So why is that a bad sentiment?
I think that's a bad sentiment because it places, I'll say, unrealistic expectations on your launch. And when you don't meet those expectations, it's not only mentally draining, but it's also going to put you in a position where you're starting to look for excuses. Why didn't this work? What didn't go right? And you're going to basically put blame everywhere except for where your expectations should have been. And I just don't think that it's good for your mental health. I think that being able to quit your job 60 days after launch is just an unrealistic expectation to have for virtually anything. I mean, I can't think of anything where that sort of thing would happen. They're going to take some time to kind of get to the point where you have this steady stream of visitors and customers who are coming in and saying, yes, I'm willing to pay money for this.
Right. The problem is that if you set your expectations so high and then you fail to hit them and you fail miserably to hit them, which it's very likely you will if you think you're going to, you know, have a full-time income after 60 days, it's just very discouraging. You know, there's kind of these three dips that you hit when you're launching a product. One is about halfway through development. One is just after launch. And then the other one is like 3, 4, 5 months after launch where the buzz is worn off at the launch. And this will just contribute to that all the more and will, you know, encourage you to basically bail on the product. Our fifth sentiment that doesn't bode well for your startup is, it would take me as much time to explain this task to someone else, so I'll just do it myself. You know, Mike, I think we should start a Startups for the Rest of Us drinking game, because we talk so much about VAs and outsourcing and even outsourcing to developers and designers that every time we mention it, everyone listening should have to do a shot.
You know, I think that's a great idea. I think that our listeners should start sending things in. So anyone who's listening, please send us some stuff to questions@startupsforthestofus.com. Send us your thoughts about what should go into the podcast drinking game where, you know, anything we say or something somebody asks, that should go in. You know, every time that comes up, you take a drink.
Right. Because that has been a recurring theme since episode one of not trying to do everything yourself, and especially not using the excuse of, it would take me as much time to explain this task to someone else, so I'll just do it myself. I think the one that I found to be the most kind of impactful to me is that it always feels this way the first time you have to hire a developer, the first time you have to hire a designer, tier one email support, any of those things. It's like, gosh, it's 4 hours, 6 hours, 8 hours, whatever to hire this person. And this task is only a 1 or 2 hour task. Well, couple things. One, you're probably not very good at estimating, so you're probably way underestimating the actual amount of time it's going to take to do it. And two, once you have that person and you find them and they're good at this, then the next 100 times you have this come up, it's a 5 or 10 minute email to send them a task, right? A 1 hour, a 30 minute task can be outsourced really easily if you don't have to go through the hiring process. So there's this almost like this economies of scale. Once you get these first several hours of hiring them out of the way, then you can build on that. This stuff does not happen overnight, but it's about building a team of people you can rely on, even if you don't use them all the time, but you at least have them as resources, and it makes outsourcing very easy and very cost effective and time effective.
Well, the other thing that comes up is that, I was talking to somebody last night about this, which was, you know, the person I was speaking to has to do billing for a bunch of different customers and has to be done in a very specific way. And it's a lot of it's recurring things. And he's constantly just looking at this stuff saying, oh, I'll just do it myself as opposed to sending it to so-and-so to do. And, you know, I told him, I was like, why don't you just create a video, you know, do a screencast, walk through it, sign up for screencast.com and, you know, buy Camtasia Studio and just walk through the process, record it once, send it over to the person who needs to do it. And if you ever need to replace that person, or if both of you are busy and you need somebody else on your team to do it, because he's got a team of like 10 or 15 people, I was like, just send it over to him, send him the link to the video and say, this is how it needs to be done. I need you to do it. There's a new customer. They need to be added to the CRM package. You know, here's all the information that you need to do it, and here's the video that explains exactly how to do it. Please go do this and take care of this, because they are employees of yours. They're working for you. You know, just go ahead and get it done, as opposed to spending all of your time doing these things when they are repetitive tasks that somebody else can be doing.
Our sixth sentiment is, I don't want to bother with all that click-through and conversion rate nonsense. I'll just build a great product.
I love that. The click-through and conversion rate nonsense. I mean, basically what you're saying is, you know, build a better mousetrap and they will come. And building a better mousetrap is not actually a good strategy. And mousetraps themselves have really not changed over the years. And people have tried to build better mousetraps. But if you look for building a better mousetrap, there's pictures of all these really weird contraptions that just generally don't work very well. And, you know, building a better product does not draw new customers. Solving their problems draws customers.
The challenge with this is that building a successful business requires an ongoing stream of people who are interested in your product. It's over-romanticizing building software, building web apps, building startups to say that the product's going to be so good that word of mouth is going to spread, or that virality is going to spread the word, or that social media, like these are the things that are fun that we do anyways, right? People are on Twitter, on Facebook. And so thinking that that's going to be enough, that just having that good product is going to make people talk about it enough to build a sustainable business, is it's wishful thinking. Bottom line. And while you don't have to be like ultra left brain about it and do hardcore click through conversion rate analysis and just be all about the numbers, you can move a little more towards the center. Every entrepreneur that I know who has been successful in the long term has a really good handle on what their conversion rates, click throughs, like what their numbers are for their business. I don't know anyone who does it who doesn't know that. Anytime someone has a business and I ask them, where's your marketing? And they say, it's all word of mouth. Hugely skeptical right away. I'm hugely skeptical that either A, is their business actually successful? And B, is it really word of mouth? Or is this person just attributing all these other, you know, these other things that are happening to word of mouth because they don't know any better? This may be the one that I don't think is talked about very much. I think it's wishful thinking to believe that the product is enough to make a successful business. Our seventh sentiment is, my idea is pretty hard to explain. Do you have 20 minutes to spare? So this is probably comes back to the, you know, kind of the enterprise software, the high-touch software versus the being able to sell on the web. The problem with having something that's so complicated and you can't explain it in a couple of sentences is that it's very hard to sell. It means that you have to educate your market, which is very expensive and time consuming, and you have to educate a lot of people and only a few of those people will buy. It also means it's extremely hard to do like paid customer acquisition because you have to send them through a long funnel. You can't just have a headline that explains what your product does. If you can't explain it in 30 characters, you know, which is, I think it's 32 characters is a, you know, a Facebook headline, or 50 something characters is an AdWords headline. If you can't explain your product, then you have to go a different route that's almost a route, like a lead gen route, and you have to have a headline that kind of addresses part of their problem, and then either have them talk to salespeople, go through autoresponders, download reports. All those are good tactics to do long-term for any business, and they will expand your sales. But if you can't make any sales without them, then you're basically in medium to high-touch sales all the time, and that's just a different business than, you know, I think as a solopreneur or a micropreneur than you want to be in.
I think the other side of it is that if you can't explain it succinctly, then it's very difficult to convey that to new customers very quickly. And when people hit your website, they're just going to leave very quickly. And I think I ran into this problem, I think, a lot earlier on with Audit Shark, where it was very difficult for me to explain to people what it is that Audit Shark does and why you would want to do it. You know, I still feel like I'm tweaking the response and what I'm telling people. But basically, I feel like Audit Shark is a product that brings clarity to the security posture of your web servers. And that's really it. It just tells you where your servers stand with regards to security, how vulnerable they are, et cetera.
Right. And I think there, you know, with this one, my idea is pretty hard to explain. Do you have 20 minutes to spare? I think there are two ways to look at it. One is either that your idea really is that hard, and that's obviously a danger sign, or your idea isn't actually that hard and you just don't know how to explain it yet. And that's also a danger sign. It means you, and you can correct that one, right? You can learn the language of your customers. We talked about that last episode. And you can just learn how to more succinctly describe it. And that's absolutely a requirement if you do plan to sell online, like you said, through a sales or marketing website. So rounding out our eight sentiments is, I don't want to talk publicly about my idea because someone might steal it.
This has got to be one, you know, take a drink.
This is the other drinking game one, I know. We get quite a few emails with a question, but the person won't tell us their idea. They just say, oh, it's in the kind of commerce space, and here's this question. But the answer to it depends entirely on having more specifics.
So the issue with this is that if you're not talking about your idea, then it's very difficult to find people who are going to basically tell you you're crazy, that it's not a very good idea. If you're not telling people what the idea is, then who are you talking to about what problems you're actually solving? And if it's a known problem, then people are presumably already talking about it and searching for it. So it's not like it's a giant secret. The other side of it is that the second you launch, it's out in public. I mean, everybody knows about your idea at that point because, you know, the world is connected to the internet, so everyone can see it. It's not like you're able to hide anything at that point. So if somebody really has tons of money and wants to come steal your idea, they're going to do it. But the problem is that nobody wants to steal bad ideas. What they want to do is they want to steal successful ideas. So if you have an idea, you can tell everybody in the world and nobody's going to care. But if it's a good idea that you follow through with and you're successful with it, that's when people are going to start copying you. That's when people are going to start taking your idea and trying to implement it or come after you with more money. But it's not until you've proven that that idea is successful that anybody's going to care.
Right. And there's a difference here between going on a podcast with several thousand people listening and saying, here's what I'm going to build and here's exactly what I'm going to build and how I'm going to market it and all the steps I'm going to take. I mean, that would be stupid, right? You're basically giving away a plan of something that is actually valuable. But talking to people in person or over the phone, mentioning it to some people, asking people and saying, hey, I'd appreciate if you didn't tell everyone about this, but here's the idea. What do you think? And getting really in depth about it, there's not much risk in doing that, right? Even going on the podcast, Mike, if you and I were to sit here and talk about it and I were to spell out a whole idea, I question how many people would even move forward with that and how many people would be able to, you know, basically to outmarket you, even if you gave them most of the broad tips of how to do it. Because everyone has their own idea and they all want to implement it, right? They don't want to implement your idea. They tend to want to implement their own because they're passionate about it. And that's probably another sentiment that doesn't bode well for your startup, is being able to adopt other people's ideas or acquire startups that are failing rather than just the traditional, I'm going to build a novel product and launch it like, you know, like every other developer does.
Well, I think I have a perfect example for this. I mean, Jason and Justin from the Tech Zinc podcast talked about the idea of AnyFoo, where their product idea was essentially providing a marketplace where if you need a expert on whatever the topic is, it can be a programming topic, it could be C#, it could be, you know, Azure, it could be Ruby, it could be Rails, you know, whatever. I mean, any of those topics, there are experts out there. And their idea was to essentially build a website where you provide a marketplace for going and hiring these people. Now, obviously, you're not going to hire them for an extended period of time because they're going to probably charge you a bare minimum of $100. And they talked publicly about this for a long time. They said, somebody should build a website where you go there and I can pay $200 to talk to an expert on security for an hour just to pick his brain, to get some thoughts and figure out what I should be doing and, you know, what sort of things that I'm missing in the existing things that I'm doing. And they talked about it for a year. They told their entire listener base, hey, somebody please implement it. And nobody did. So they finally decided to actually follow through and start building it themselves because nobody else had. They're publicly talking about it and they're actually asking people to go do it. And not one person steps up and goes to steal that idea.
Yeah, there's so much more that goes into building a business than the idea. Basically, the idea is a small piece of it. And having a great idea is great, but there's so much execution and work and expertise and development and marketing that goes into it that just having someone know your idea is not enough for them. Even if they get there first, is not enough for them to beat you if you can outmarket them. Well, that about wraps us up for today. To review, our 8 sentiments that do not bode well for your startup are, 1, this product idea is awesome. Now off to the basement to build it. See you in 6 months. 2, I haven't even finished the features I want to build yet, and potential customers are already asking me to build X. 3, I'm halfway done with this idea, but that shiny new one over there seems so much better. 4, I plan to quit my day job 60 days after I launch.
5, it would take me as much time to explain this task to someone else, so I'll just do it myself. 6, I don't want to bother with all that click-through and conversion rate nonsense. I'll just build a great product. 7, my idea is pretty hard to explain. Do you have 20 minutes to spare? And 8, I don't want to talk publicly about my idea because someone might steal it.
If you have a question or comment, you can call it into our voicemail number at 888-801-9690 or email it at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to this podcast in iTunes by searching for Startups or via RSS at startupsfortherestofus.com, where you'll also find a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.